Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled Everybody's Protest Novel and Edmund Wilson, The Early Criticism of James Baldwin. Our speaker is Dr. Lawrence Jackson, Emory University Professor of English and African American Studies. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University's African American Studies Program Director, Linda Haywood.
Today, the African American Studies Program is pleased to introduce, as our speaker, Lawrence Jackson, who is Professor of English and African American Studies at Emory University. Professor Jackson earned his PhD at Stanford University in 1997, and he began his teaching career at Howard University in Washington, D.C. He joined Emory's faculty in 2002, the year his biography, Ralph Ellison, Emergence of Genius, was published. His most recent book is called The Indignant Generation, A Narrative History of African-American Writers and Critics, 1934 to 1960, which was published by Princeton University Press in 2010. His forthcoming books include From the Stoughton to the Dan, Slavery, the Civil War, and an Afro-American Family, and a biography of Chester Himes. He has lectured widely in the United States and abroad, and he was featured in a 2002 documentary on Ralph Ellison's life. Professor Jackson offers courses primarily in 19th and 20th century African-American literature and culture, shaped by his interest in urban studies, social class formation, realism and modernism, popular culture, black nationalism, and decolonization theory. Thank you. I'll now like to call up Professor Jackson.
Thank you, Professor Haywood, for such a generous introduction, and I should let everybody know that we are former colleagues from Howard University, so we have a past, I mean, I guess as all good academics do. It's delightful, really, to be here this afternoon with you all, and I want to thank Gene Jarrett for, sort of beginning the conversation that's allowed me to be here today. What I'm going to actually do today, I'm going to talk about James Baldwin, and to give you a literary period that sort of was in between the Harlem Renaissance and the Black Arts Movement. We have very competent historical studies and really very extensive literary treatments of the 1920s, African American writing in the 1920s, and African American writing in the 1960s and 1970s. And though there was a great deal of individual work, I mean, especially biographical work on people like Richard Wright and James Baldwin, I wrote a biography of Ralph Ellison, Arne Rampersad wrote a biography of Ralph Ellison, George Kent wrote a biography of Gwendolyn Brooks. There was really no single work that operated synthetically to bring the people together. And what I wanted to do, you know, thinking in mind of somebody like Jacob Carruthers, who always informs us that in some ways there's intellectual warfare that goes on. And I felt very strongly that so many of these writers had been removed from the terrain of intellectual camaraderie and fellowship with other African Americans. Especially in the biographical studies, there was a tendency to see them in isolation, almost complete isolation, in my view, when the life of James Baldwin and the life of Richard Wright were treated. It just so happens that their major biographers are not European-American, but actually Europeans. And often, since those men spent such a great portion of their lives overseas, the biographical treatments tended to reflect, very many of their international connections. And so that's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to read to you a segment from the book that describes James Baldwin's early career. And it's really one of my favorite parts of the work. I got a note from a reviewer at the London Review of Books a couple of days ago, and he said, well, you know, I really like the book, and I really like what you're doing. I don't really agree with what you're saying about James Baldwin, but, you know, we have room for some disagreement. But I very much like to talk about Baldwin as somebody that's produced, I mean, as the work of Herb Boyd emphasizes, somebody that's produced in Harlem and then, you know, sort of goes on to become very well known as the most prominent black anti-communist critic. I mean, and by that, I mean, actually, he's a Cold War liberal. He has great credentials as a Cold War liberal. And it is James Baldwin who repudiates sort of acts of literary naturalism and literary realism in the second half of the 1940s. And, of course, Baldwin is understood today, you know, very much as the great antagonist to Richard Wright. And though there certainly is something to that, he actually begins his work repudiating naturalism with Chester Himes, and he actually has possibly has a greater role in ending the career as a naturalist writer of Chester Himes than he impacted perhaps the career of Richard Wright. And then what I also show in the book, I talk about the way that Baldwin's essay, his very famous essay from 1949, and we just should all remember that James Baldwin comes to us today, I mean, still really recognized not as a novelist, but as a literary critic, as an essayist. I mean, he's perhaps best known, I think his best-selling work is probably The Fire Next Time. But that this essay from 1949, Everybody's Protest Novel, was in some ways really, it was a heavyweight criticism at Edmund Wilson, who came out in a New Yorker essay in 1948 in favor of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. And so you know that the Everybody's Protest Novel is really about Uncle Tom's Cabin. It sort of attaches Native Son at the very end of it. But I think that Baldwin was sort of being used and manipulated is too strong a word. I can't think of something that's in the middle range right now. But that his friends from Partisan Review, who had some mild animosity, or were certainly in the process of rejecting what Edmund Wilson stood for at the second half of the 1940s, I think that they had something to do with the circumstances of the publication of that essay. So I'm going to talk to you about the early career and sort of foundation of James Baldwin. And I just say that the book is called The Indignant Generation. This is a copy of the book. It is titled from a letter of Ralph Ellison, a phrase from a letter that Ralph Ellison wrote to Richard Wright in 1940 in praise of Native Son. And he described the indignant consciousness of Bigger Thomas in that letter as sort of offering the possibility for transformation in black consciousness in the United States. And it's precisely that kind of transformation that I've tried to describe over the passage of 25 years or so. But again, this is James Baldwin. The publishing career of critic James Baldwin, the most consistent anti-naturalist and anti-social protest critic of the 1940s and 1950s, began in the spring of 1947 and soared like a meteor for the next 15 months until it burst into long-lasting literary celebrity in the early 1950s. Baldwin's success continues to be a source of debate for the people who knew him, both casually and well, during the 40s. After he was famous, he was adopted by the elites. In retrospect, colorful Mary McCarthy claimed him eagerly as the young black critic who possessed intuitive taste. Her clever remarks tended to be supported by people who adored her at one time or other, like Philip Roth, Alfred Kazin, and Norman Potteritz. Certainly some of the facts are indisputable. Basically, three journals, New Leader, Commentary, and Partisan Review, provided Baldwin's education and turned him into a critical force. And of course, this made Baldwin extraordinary. Black talent no longer collected on the left at New Masses, Nation, and New Republic. It was being raised by journals that had galloped from the left to the center, and which typically had been begun by American Jews if New Leader and Partisan Review eschewed an outright ethnic focus. With the exception of Anatole Briard and Richard Gibson, none of Baldwin's contemporaries could boast of that level of succor from something like a quarter of the makers of American literary taste. In the 1960s, Baldwin told his first biographer, Fern Ekman, that he was given reviews for the same reason that he was given fellowships. There were no other blacks on the scene, and white editors were oddly curious about a black boy who wanted to write. But this is not really true. Plenty of blacks wanted to make it as writers, and Baldwin had known precisely the kind of poverty that would have kept him away from the literati who claimed to have eagerly embraced him in his youth. Born in 1924 and bred in a New York tenement at 731 East 131st Street, about a block and a half from Harlem Hospital where he entered the world, James Baldwin grew into young manhood among black Southern refugees trying to scrape by as janitors, laborers, laundresses, and servants in the most expensive city in America. They'd fled small towns in Virginia, South Carolina, and Georgia. His stepfather's mother, Barbara, who lived on their floor, was 90 years old when Baldwin was born, and she spent a significant portion of the 19th century enslaved in Louisiana. She gave birth to her son David when she was in her 50s. James Baldwin read his way out of the local library on 135th Street, but he was a shy youngster. He lived in a house dominated by his evangelical stepfather, and including a mother who was pregnant 9 of every 18 months, a stepbrother nearly 10 years his elder, and a grandmother who seemed from another era of time altogether. Baldwin grasped the racial apartheid at work in his life and became adept at negotiating a different sort of path, away from the career as a menial laborer that awaited most people he knew. He tried to please his father by joining the church in the Depression, but his ability and early recognition from white teachers freed him from the constraints at home. In junior high, the poet County Cullen taught him French. By high school, he was writing stories and working on the school newspaper. Baldwin used the war years well. He had attended League of American Writers lectures and workshops as a teenager, and like many of the young men from his school on their way to City College, gravitated toward the Socialist Political Party. He joined the Young People's Socialist League and later became a Trotskyite. He cultivated himself as he could, and the most self-conscious thing that he ever did was completely to affect his speech pattern, so that he sounded as if he'd been raised in Greenwich, Connecticut, with the high lilt and bored tone of confident blue bloods. The young Baldwin shunned watermelon, fried chicken, Bessie Smith, and the idea of race pride. But if he was consciously alienated from black people and black culture, he also had the black gamin's instinct for survival, and he was capable of turning white pity into something he could use. He was scrawny, a boyish brown-skinned man whose eyes seemed too big for his skull and his skull too big for his body. He had little chance to play the role of Negro Casanova, at which men like Ralph Ellison, Horace Caton, Roy Otley, William Attaway, Anatole Briard, and Chester Himes excelled. Baldwin's initial turmoil was compounded by the fact that he went through his early years with strong homosexual desires, which he decided to embrace in his 20s. One important thing held him together. He believed in his natural gifts. Baldwin wanted to be an artist, but it took him a while to narrow the field. He asked for jobs at newspapers in Harlem, probably in 1942, and probably at the Amsterdam News and the People's Voice. The editors laughed him out of the office, disparaging his work history as a shoeshine boy and his education that did not include even a semester at college. He thought he might do better at acting or photography. And Max Lerner, the editor of the short-lived alternative newspaper, PM, like AM, PM, took on Baldwin as a messenger and printed a couple of his photographs. Baldwin was in step with the times and hoped to improve the plight of American blacks, or, as it was better known, of race relations. And he proposed a book, Unto the Dying Lamb, similar to Richard Wright's book of photojournalism, 12 Million Black Voices. But it was depressing working at the liberal newspaper that imposed a caste system among its 4 black workers. Young Baldwin worked alongside a man his same skin color, while a very dark-skinned black man labored obscurely in the cellar. In front of the window facing the street, the position of esteem, sat a Negro of very light skin color. Inevitably, it seemed, Baldwin became known. An accomplished bohemian, but also a young reader in the slush piles at Doubleday, named Betty Arnoff, met Baldwin in Greenwich Village and introduced his work to Doubleday's associate editor, Buckland Moon. Always alert to new black talent, Moon befriended him and took him seriously. Moon thought Baldwin a talent-loaded urchin. Jimmy Baldwin was the kind of man who comes in to mooch a cup of coffee half an hour late because he didn't have subway fare and had to walk. One thing stood out in the little friendship. Despite Moon's connections in Harlem and his success publishing, he was not quite sure of himself around Baldwin. There was something that left him uneasy. For all I know, he may kill somebody with an axe tomorrow morning, but this kid has something, he wrote in a recommendation letter for Baldwin. The young black writer from Harlem possessed a murderous innocence. This quality, coupled with his improbably large talent, his determination to cultivate it, and his poverty, set people on edge. Baldwin had the relative luxury to give himself over to his talent because he avoided the draft, the bane to most of the black artists. The writers and jazz men did everything they could to slip Sam Brown. Dizzy Gillespie told the inducting examiner that he might shoot a white man. On his way to prison in confrontation with the Nation of Islam, Malcolm Little did the same. Chester Himes was married and had medical troubles. Richard Wright was never called, but the service loomed over his head. Ralph Ellison dodged the army and eventually joined the Merchant Marine, an integrated unit. The U.S. Army, with its segregated outfits and basic training in the Deep South, could be torture. Vaudeville prodigy Sammy Davis Jr. worked in an integrated unit and was forced to drink his own urine. Perhaps the most famous disfigurement of a black artist occurred in the case of Lester Young, conscripted and then court-martialed for drug possession. But the Army's destructive regimen was well known and contributed mightily to the death of historian John Hope Franklin's college-educated brother. There would be success stories in the case of some black men who traveled to Europe as GIs and returned only briefly to the United States, like William Gardner Smith and William Demby. William Attaway joined a special services unit, and Howard University professor John Lavelle and critic Russell Marshall became Army officers. But Baldwin was the oldest male in a household of nine. The government declared him 3D and did not call him up. In Greenwich Village, the traditional bohemian outpost in the United States, Baldwin was able to find a job at the Calypso, a Trinidadian restaurant filled with black jazz musicians, intellectuals, and artists, and a smidgen of cultural freedom. At the McDougal Street restaurant, he saw and heard and eventually talked to Richard Wright and the internationally famous Trotskyite C.L.R. James. The village was also a place of peril that he described as an alabaster maze perched above a boiling sea. And to navigate the maze and avoid being scalded, he would need help. He formally introduced himself to two people and impressed them with his abundance of talent and artistic seriousness. Buford Delaney, the black impressionist painter, whose work had been featured at the Downtown Gallery a couple of years before, and Wright, the most famous living black writer. A 21-year-old Baldwin walked up to 181 Green Street, where Delaney then lived, and introduced himself. Delaney was hip, urban and urbane, and homosexual, as were others in Harlem and the village, like sculptor Richmond Barthe, Richard Bruce Nugent, and Cullen, who died in 1946. A rather daring abstractionist painter, Delaney fairly quickly initiated young James Baldwin into the world of the artist. Delaney showed Baldwin how to see differently, to look at a puddle of water, and because of the motor oil, catch a reflection of the city's skyline. He introduced Baldwin to pot, but kept him away from heroin. He bought tickets so that the two of them could attend Marian Anderson's Carnegie Hall concert. Delaney played some of the great blues classics on the phonograph in his tiny apartment and made the place seem so rich with funky possibility that Baldwin imagined himself on a terrace when sitting on the fire escape. Wright, on the other hand, was the most important black writer alive and married to a white woman, father to a mixed-race child, and living in a house on 13 St. Charles Place. Which must have seemed to Baldwin ensconced in a surreal interracial fantasy. After he bought the house in the spring of 1945, Wright received the 21-year-old Baldwin by pouring out bourbon, combining elements of Southern formality and Southern clannishness, which Baldwin recognized from his own parents and relatives. Baldwin accepted Wright as an institution, somehow beyond friendship. Wright delivered for Baldwin a Saxton Fellowship in the winter of 1945, the first tangible proof of the young man's creative aptitude. I wanted to thank you for your aid and your kindness to me. It's one of the most wonderful things that's ever happened to me, Baldwin wrote to his mentor in a rare moment of graceful satisfaction. Before the end of 1945, Baldwin felt like he had a workable draft of the novel In My Father's House. Confident and always alert to the feelings of backers he was forever wounding, he wrote to Wright months after the award, after Wright and his family had moved to France and requested an essay.
He also reminded Wright that he respected him and have for quite some time. By then, he'd taken liberty enough with Wright that it made sense, on occasion, to offer Wright praise. Baldwin was always polite, but he was never awed by Wright's stature. The Saxton Fellowship gave Baldwin a sense of his ability, but his success as a published writer was owed to other courts. Through his Young People's Socialist League contacts, Baldwin became known to Saul Levitas, the editor of the socialist newspaper New Leader. Housed on the fourth floor of the Rand School building at 15th Street and 5th Avenue, New Leader had succeeded the American Socialist Party's paper Leader in 1924. When the Socialist Party, headed by Norman Thomas, split over its support of New Deal policies, the New Leader remained with Roosevelt and leftist politics and began mounting a campaign of anti-communism. With a bookstore at the offices and regular public lectures by the likes of Max Schachtman, the labor hero, the founder of analytic philosophy Bertrand Russell, and Professor Sidney Hook, there was an intellectual zing in the air at New Leader. What Partisan Review meant to the anti-Stalinist on the cultural front, New Leader meant to them on the political front. The magazine exposed everything from the Moscow trials and Soviet massacres to the collusion over patents between German manufacturer I.G. Farben and Rockefeller's New Jersey-based Standard Oil. Young City College student Daniel Bell was one of its editors, and the newspaper operated with a sense of duty, daring, and anti-propaganda zeal. There was also a more tangible feeling of excitement and consequence connected to the journal, too. Popular Italian anti-fascist writer and lecturer Carlo Tresca had been assassinated on the street outside the office in 1943. The only African-American to have published in the newspaper was Claude McKay, who had moved to Chicago, embraced Catholicism, and would die in 1948. But 10 years earlier, McKay had used the paper as a forum to begin exploring the pernicious effects of communism among African-American intellectuals. New Leader's literary editor was Isaac Rosenfeld, the man who had already put a torch to Chester Himes. Round-faced and heavyset, the University of Chicago graduate was frequently considered the bright star of his generation by people like Saul Bellow and Alfred Kazin. Rosenfeld was in the midst of accomplishing much of what Baldwin would increasingly see as important. He published a novel in 1946 called Passage from Home that had been rewardingly reviewed as developing away from a Jewish genre novel into a book of profound universal meaning. This seemed to be the triumph of universal humanism over sectarian ethnicity, which had been the traditional mark of acceptance for the Jewish writers, who still had not comfortably claimed the ethnic heritage of the ghetto neighborhoods of the American Northeast. Rosenfeld left the field of creative fiction and became known for his criticism. He came to know Baldwin well enough to write his recommendation letter for the Rosenwald Fellowship in 1948. And I just mentioned that one of the main thrusts of the book is to describe the impact of three institutions in the cultivation of a cadre of African-American writers. So one institution is the Communist Party. Another institution is the Federal Writers Project, the WPA Creative Arts organ. And the third one is the Julius Rosenwald Foundation. And the Julius Rosenwald Fellowship gave close to 800 creative, well, not creative writing fellowships, but a combination of creative writing, visual arts, musical arts fellowships to African Americans between roughly 1934 and 1948. It had a gigantic impact. I mean, an impact that can't be overestimated, really, in terms of enabling people to have 2 years or a year to work on creative writing projects. Everybody that you've ever heard of got one. So it was a main engine. Rosenfeld's position on blacks was aggressively liberal but complicated. He could be understood as pro-Negro, but Rosenfeld understood blackness in the classic sense of those around Commentary magazine. Blackness was a kind of stain of difference separating blacks from union with the majority of Americans. He had written in the novel Passage from Home, "Or think for a moment, what was it like to be a Negro? I could only imagine myself to be obsessed if I were one. I should go about thinking, I am black, I am black." For Rosenfeld, the central question for the Negro was the problem of overcoming physical difference a difference premised on a white norm and an absolute blackness. Understandably, Rosenfeld was attracted to James Baldwin, who proved his liberal largesse and accepted the same viewpoint, that the physical manifestations of black speech and ethnic characteristics were to be transcended in the movement to universal humanity. But even if he thought blackness a disability, Rosenfeld's opinion of Baldwin was tremendous. He believed the young man from Harlem noble. His courage is twofold. It consists in his honesty and in his desire and great ability to express the truth, he wrote to the Rosenwald judges. And this is a paragraph from the letter. I value him as a friend, as a man, and a writer for his great personal dignity and understanding. He has a sympathy, rare in the rarest of men, that can penetrate outward disorder to the inner meaning, where the fact that men suffer degradation and the significance for human culture of that degradation are one. This inner, broader meaning, the cultural sense, is not separated from him by any area of vagueness, rhetoric, or morally self-conscious goodwill. It is an immediate, painful perception. It is this which gives him the right to say, we, are, when he speaks both for Negroes and for America. He has instinctively. I know of no one with greater authority to speak both the part and the whole. In about 15 years, the Nation of Islam national spokesperson, Malcolm X, would make the ideal of a black and white we the object of scorn in his most important speech, A Message to the Grassroots. But in the mid-1940s, for a black man to speak of we and include himself as an American and pretend to speak for whites was nothing short of miraculous. By the time Baldwin met Partisan Review editors Philip Rav, William Phillips, and Mary McCarthy, he would remind McCarthy of Delmore Schwartz, the young prodigy of their set. McCarthy met him for lunch in the company of Phillips, probably in 1948, at the Blue Ribbon restaurant on the West Side. She was surprised by him and believed that the fact that his reading was not colored by his color was an unusual trait. McCarthy, who famously married Edmund Wilson while living with Philip Raff, reflected the patronizing snobbery of her group. Her judgment that Baldwin was the first black literary intellectual, she knew, may indeed be true, but Baldwin was certainly not the first that she could have known. Her suggestion that Baldwin had some expert facility that enabled him to evaluate art without a flawed racial consciousness is also disingenuous. McCarthy did not read Phylon, this is W.B. Du Bois' journal from the mid-40s, or know of other black critics. In 1947 and 1948, the best prose narrative stylist among African Americans, Ann Petrie, Zora Neale Hurston, Frank Yerby, and Willard Motley, all published novels featuring white protagonists. The trend was thought to herald the dawn of mature race relations and black self-conscious identity. Since the Partisan Review crowd had, after their 1937 rebirth, ceased to interact with Sterling Brown, Richard Wright, Claude McKay, and then as they came along, J. Saunders Redding, Ralph Ellison, C.L.R. James, Ann Petrie, and Carl Offord, intensely intellectual New York black writers, with the exception of the commuters Brown and Redding, who, you know, were in Washington, D.C. and Hampton, Virginia, they would now turn to precocious youngsters like Baldwin for what they needed. James Baldwin's first New Leader review in May 1947 showed him quite different from what he would become. He scrutinized Irving Shulman's novel of Jewish gangs in Brooklyn, The Amboy Dukes, and thought the straightforward narrative had special meaning because, like Native Son, it made a broad and pessimistic social indictment. He was raw. He does not say, but seems to know, that recreation halls and basketball games, the first resort of the civic-minded, is a procedure about as effective as the application of Vaseline to a syphilitic lesion. A couple of weeks later, Baldwin popped up in Nation, where poet Randall Jarrell, a man of Vanderbilt agrarian aesthetics and slightly Marxist politics, was editor. The subject was more typical of what Baldwin's liberal friends had in mind for the young critic, African-American literature. Baldwin reviewed the workaholic writer Shirley Graham's There Was Once a Slave and showed an impatient fury that probably hinted at his resentment for being pigeonholed. He was good enough to catch the notice of Nation, but not good enough to get a first-class book. On the other hand, it was appropriate to give the biography of Frederick Douglass to a fiction reviewer because the book was fiction. Baldwin called Graham's version of Douglass unbelievable and bereft of dignity and humanity alike, chiefly because she is obviously so determined to uplift the race. In the treatment of Offord and Petrie and Wright by the better class of intellectual reviewers, the uplift the race criteria had received some exploration. And now in the hands of a young black reviewer and an inarguably second-rate book, a new bar had been set up. Forevermore, race propaganda was ideology, plain and simple, and the only valuable contribution lay in art and form. Baldwin would write again for New Leader in September, a review of the book The Sling and the Arrow by Frank Marshall Davis's friend Stuart Engstrom. And it should be said that the plot anticipates a book Baldwin himself would publish in another 9 years, Giovanni's Room. But his important task in his debut year as a critic was his fall review of the second novel of Chester Himes. The world would always believe that Chester Himes had a rather unimaginative persecution complex. In September 1947, a short 18 months after his novelistic debut, Chester Himes published the sophomore novel Lonely Crusade. The second book revealed the ugly joint between race, sex, and labor in wartime California aircraft plants. Himes created a protagonist named Lee Gordon, and he set the book within the range of American life in which he was expert. Gordon, a college-educated black man, has firsthand experiences with communism, labor unions, corporate management, and interracial sex. The book epitomized the storm brewing over realistic representations of the interracial American landscape. For Himes, even the publicity received by the book bespoke the discomfort and jeopardy of the new climate to black writers. Himes thought that the new book would succeed and transform him into a major figure, like Petrie, and bring middle-class acceptance, which he had still failed to win. Instead, the September publication day of the book that should have put him into the league with Richard Wright turned into a nightmare. The ferry taking Himes from Brooklyn to Manhattan broke down, and he was 45 minutes late to Macy's flagship store in downtown Manhattan, where he'd been scheduled to meet with the bookstore clerks before work began. At Bloomingdale's on East 59th Street, Himes did not even get to see the manager before he knew that no copies of the book were for sale. Then the Mary Margaret McBride radio program for the Central Broadcasting System canceled his afternoon interview after a transcript that Himes had made for another program, This Is New York, was broadcast. He had every expectation for success with the interview. A year earlier, in April of 1946, Himes had shared the program with Ann Petrie and Mark Harris, author of Trumpet to the World. An ex-con who thought he might never get an even break, Himes took the experience to heart. It was then that I decided to leave the United States forever if I got the chance. And another major portion of the book, I treat the black expatriate writers that include Chester Himes, James Baldwin, and Richard Wright. Lonely Crusade sold poorly, and in fact, the experience of publishing the work at all was excruciating for the author. Ralph Ellison, disappointed in his friend's book, thought that, among other things, Himes had misjudged the extent of the escalating Red Scare, the euphemism used by the wary during the months between the loyalty oath and the indictment of CPUSA's leadership on charges of sedition. Himes had concluded Lonely Crusade with a long, sympathetic conversation between protagonist Lee Gordon and a communist, which influences Gordon's final Pyrrhic gesture to unionism. Audiences would not gravitate to a book that showed communists as wise liberators. Opportunity Journal dismissed Himes' paper-thin characters and unilluminated concern with violence. The best that New Republic could do was to say that, overall, the achievement was unsettling. J. Saunders Redding condemned the same flawed, frightened men that he disliked in Himes' first novel, If He Hollers, Let Him Go. In Lonely Crusade, the same error is made, Redding wrote in his weekly review. He deliberately creates heroes with 100 petty flaws in order to show how weak and foolish and depthless even heroes are. The real theme Redding found was simply fear, the fear that the author seems to believe is the only natural endowment of the colored man in the white world. There was one critic who unequivocally supported the value of the book. Horace Caton fought with his black audiences to take to heart unflattering messages from black novelists. It will offend a lot of people, Caton admitted of Lonely Crusade, but it's closer to the truth than most anything I've read recently. Caton thought that the black audience was overly inclined to see the truth as relative only to their own personal experience. Caton warned them away from judging literature by virtue of its ability to mirror their own lives. "You don't have to read the book and say, 'I wouldn't have acted that way,'" Caton explained in a short course on literary criticism. And Caton was the regular critic and book reviewer and in some ways sort of the black nationalist and internationalist at the Pittsburgh Courier. "You don't have to make generalizations about all trade unions or about the Communist Party or about the amount of anxiety you might have felt. But given the character Lee, given the situation, Lonely Crusade, written by Chester Himes, is a great book." Himes was the first black novelist that James Baldwin reviewed, and though he would review more, it would never be that many. It seemed to Baldwin immediately that he was being pushed into the corner of minority rights book reviewer, and in his mind, he saw thousands of tract-like, formulaic pamphlets emerging on racial and ethnic relations and goading Americans to do the right thing. Nevertheless, the assignment for the October 1947 New Leader was difficult. Baldwin conceded twice that the prose of Lonely Crusade was uninteresting and awkward, and some of the worst writing on this side of the Atlantic, which was also a political jab aimed, it would seem, at Jean-Paul Sartre. He claimed that Himes had tried to do too much, but that his integrity as a writer, the value he placed on honesty, commanded the recognition of some merits of the book. "The value of this book lies in its earnest effort to understand the psychology of the oppressed and oppressor and their relationship to each other. The book contained an historical importance not unlike that accorded Uncle Tom's Cabin or, more recently, Native Son." But the essence of what he had to say was directed against the unraveling of the plot and the creation of the lead character. Baldwin criticized Chester Himes for leaving the protagonist no way out of his morass. "Unlike Bigger Thomas, gone to his death cell, inarticulate and destroyed by his need for identification and revenge, and with only the faintest intimation in that twilight of what destroyed him and of what his life might have been, Mr. Himes' protagonist, Lee Gordon, sees what has happened and what is happening and watches helplessly the progress of his own disease. And there is no path out. In a group so pressed down, terrified and at bay, and carrying generations of constricted, subterranean hostility, no real group identification is possible. Nor is there a Negro tradition to cling to in the sense that the Jews may be said to have a tradition. This was left in Africa long ago, and no one remembers it now. Lee Gordon is forced back on himself. Not even bitterness can serve him as a weapon anymore." About 6 months into his career, Baldwin had sketched out a critical paradigm that he adhered to throughout the 1950s. Looking to writers as cultural soothsayers, he believed that wallowing in bitterness and indignation was flawed because it led to violence and self-destruction, either of the black self, of the black people, or of the American nation. He also suggested that there was no cultural retreat for black Americans because they were a people without a tradition that might enable a conscious return. This was the price that came with the resurrection of Henry James, who thought American cultural traditionless, a notion that appeared in the work of Lionel Trilling and Richard Wright. Baldwin seemed to suggest that to reach full maturity, black writers would necessarily be indistinguishable, thematically, from whites. Baldwin's review for the anti-communist press differed in only one small way from New Masses. Himes had ridiculed the party's approach to African Americans by making the chief black leftist a kind of caricature. The black communist Luther is described by the narrator as an ape on several occasions, and he participates in crude and degrading relationships with white women and men. Although Himes had written favorably of the other communists, his work could be accused of endorsing black inferiority. Breaking into print with some of his earliest criticism, the Communist Party critic Lloyd Brown seemed like the CPUSA's biting black pit bull eliminating race chauvinism when he exaggerated, "I cannot recall ever having read a worse book on the Negro theme." In the same character, Baldwin had found impeccable quality. The Uncle Tom named Luther is handled and seen so accurately that no white man ever again should dare to turn his back on any Negro he feels he has bought and conquered. The murderous potential of the harmless black toy fascinated Baldwin as well as Himes. And I'll conclude there, and in some ways the final paragraph and James Baldwin's interest in the character Luther McGregor, who, you know, if you're not familiar with the novel Lonely Crusade, is he's an extraordinary character, and he concludes his dramatic portions in the novel with a soliloquy on, you could boil it down to black essentialism. What he says, literally, he calls his soliloquy, it's, I'm a nigger first, is the gist of it, right? This is a quote from the book. And what I show or try to demonstrate throughout the latter portion of the book, the last third of the book, is that Baldwin will reverse himself on these points. And actually, he will, by the end of the 1950s, come to find a great deal of strength and resiliency in African-American culture, African-American vernacular culture. And he will move away from the liberal backers who launched his career. And he prepares himself really in these conversations and dialogues that he's having with Lorraine Hansberry, John Oliver Killens, and Malcolm X. He prepares himself really for a very different kind of role in the 1960s than he had had in the late 40s and the first half of the 1950s. And for me, this is really the transformation in one person, at least, of this kind of indignation. I mean, in some ways, maybe it's a developing or a reclamation of indignation in the case of James Baldwin. But with his career trajectory, I think that we can really see the way that the groundwork is laid for a different kind of sensibility among African-American writers in the 1960s. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I was wondering, how different was Baldwin's generation from the earlier generation of the Harlem Renaissance movement? Because you did have also this kind of a liberal alliance between black-white liberalism. And to what extent, you know, would a Padmore or any of those writers, Home to Harlem and so on, they seem to also have gone through that. And I wonder if Baldwin and that generation was in fact experiencing this in some ways differently than that earlier generation.
In some ways, the key difference is the way that the country deals with the Depression. Prior to the rise of James Baldwin, it would be very difficult for people to make a living as a black literary critic apart from any kind of institution. So the best-known black critic in the United States in the 1940s is J. Saunders Redding. I mean, he's an English professor, you know, who teaches at Elizabeth City College, and then he teaches at Hampton beginning in 1944. He writes a weekly column for the Afro-American newspaper. In fact, a couple of other black literary critics like Arthur P. Davis, who had been writing for the Virginia Pilot and Sentinel, they'll be writing, you know, sort of these regular review columns and sustaining themselves at institutions. Now, because they work for the institutions, I mean, Howard winds up being significant because Mordecai Johnson protected the faculty. He actually didn't fire people for leftist affiliation, and he defended them in public, which is very rare. Saunders Redding, in fact, is one of the great critics of African-American college professors and the administrative bureaucracy that existed at the HBCUs during that time and in some ways exists today. I mean, African-American colleges and universities are conservatively run. So for somebody like Redding, there was a question of, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. Langston Hughes had a great deal of freedom, but had to struggle and was quite vulnerable. Hughes had in my view, he and James Weldon Johnson would have had the most important aesthetic statements or artistic statements from the Harlem Renaissance, The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain, which, again, is going to be published and carried by the liberal press. But Hughes is developing a basis of support, really, that's in the black community and that's almost autonomous in a fairly unique way.
when the Depression comes, the writers' projects that are strong, there are about 106 African-American writers that participate on the Federal Writers Project, and mainly in Chicago and New York, and the different CP organs. I mentioned that Baldwin is involved in the League of American Writers. He attends some of these conferences. So you have an annual League of American Writers conference, which is supposed to bring together, I mean, it changes according to the Communist Party line at different moments, but it's supposed to bring together published writers, young writers, experimental writers. You know, it's supposed to be in some ways a certain kind of clearinghouse, but it enables African Americans who are, you know, officially outside of the mainstream to begin to approach some of the lineaments of the commercial publishing industry. They can think about it in a very different way, in a way that would have been impossible for Langston Hughes in the 1920s outside of Carl Van Vechten's salon, outside of the Opportunity Journal meeting, you know, where they very much could have demanded, you know, a certain kind of behavior or a certain kind of dress. I mean, you know, there could have been all kinds of strictures allowing inclusion and demanding separation. And so, and Baldwin, in my view, is very much a person that would have been, you know, he would have been separated. I mean, again, he's coming from an impoverished background. Langston Hughes was a member of what was understood as the black elite. I mean, there wasn't money behind it, but, you know, in terms of a certain kind of pedigree and some connections that he could take for granted. I mean, Hughes was an extraordinary figure, and I'm not trying to suggest that, you know, he was pretentious or, you know, elitist or snob or anything. But you have that break, and then you see in Claude McKay's career something of this transformation. McKay is a poet, novelist, memoirist, but he's also a major intellectual figure, you know, who is working so early, again, on these left-wing publications. You know, McKay and Mike Gold as editors, McKay and Max Eastman. So he's also an older figure and has a, you know, longer history. And Baldwin he's moving in something of the shadow of Claude McKay, though it's unclear to me, you know, whether or not he would have ever, even at that period in life, known who Claude McKay was. This is the thing that I think is interesting and complicated and something that we should, you know, keep trying to tease out. Who did he meet at the Calypso? What kind of people are coming through there on a regular basis? How much of an entrepot for the black intellectual crowd is this place in the Village? We know that the Village is, you know, it's always going to be significant for the bohemian group, for the artistic group. I mean, they're wanting to go to the Village and to make it in the Village. But, you know, is this going to be sort of the first place that would cause James Baldwin to think more complexly about, you know, sort of how he understands, you know, sort of white power, privilege, access to, you know, sort of decision making or decision shaping, public opinion making journals and magazines, and the way that he understands what's taking place in Harlem? I mean, we could sort of understand that C.B. Powell is the founding editor of Amsterdam News. I don't know if he's still editor of Amsterdam News in the 1940s. But, you know, the Amsterdam News is gonna be the home of the black people who are well-connected. The People's Voice was another kind of interesting chance. This is Adam Clayton Powell's newspaper, very left, very radical. Mid-40s winds up being edited by Doxie Wilkerson, Howard University professor who joins the Communist Party in 1946. Completely reverses the trajectory that we would think about in terms of African-Americans being connected with radical left-wing politics in the United States. I mean, or, you know, when we think about blacks joining the CP, we think about them in the great train of everybody else. And, you know, you sort of, once the Moscow trials and once the Nazi-Soviet pact, that everybody, you know, starts to say, well, you know, we've got to go away. And then certainly you have Wright and Ellison more or less moving away after the support of the segregated blood banks during the Second World War. But you have so many black intellectuals who, when it is at the most difficult point in 1946, you know, sort of Cold War speeches and that sort of thing, who are going in strong with the CP. But People's Voice is also edited by Ann Petrie, works on People's Voice as a reporter, and Marvell Cook, the important black journalist Marvell Cook. And so I wonder, you know, sort of how Baldwin would have understood this group of blacks who, you know, at least in terms of their political philosophy, wouldn't have been, you know, sort of professionally snobbish or something, and but still were operating basically, I would say, in what might have seemed sort of a formal anti-bohemian kind of attitude. And I imagine that being around, you know, Adam Clayton Powell, it would have been, you know, that you would have seen showmanship, the emphasis on showmanship and, you know, sort of performance and glamour, you know, with somebody like Powell. I could see Baldwin, you know, in sort of a 21, 22-year-old James Baldwin, you know, sort of seeing Powell and just going the other way, like, you know, me and this guy, I never hit it off, you know, or never sort of make it together. But I think that that's, you know, we want to try to do as much as we can with that. It's fascinating. You know, we talk about, again, the Salon with Van Vechten or Mabel Dodge Lewin with the Salon, and very arguably that we can have the same kind of important place with this restaurant in Greenwich Village. Now, if Claudia Jones is going to the restaurant, and you've got James there, and you know you've got Wright there, I mean, they've got somewhat similar regular tables. I mean, we're talking about a place that could really be, you know, quite exciting and extraordinary. If the musicians who are traveling abroad are coming through there, you know, sort of quite regularly, it's a little bit different than just, you know, I'm working as a busboy and people are coming for a moment.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much for such a stimulating conversation.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Lawrence Jackson, Emory University Professor of English and African American Studies. Dr. Jackson's lecture was titled Everybody's Protest Novel and Edmund Wilson, The Early Criticism of James Baldwin, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was Boston University's African American Studies Program Director, Linda Haywood. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Mark Liam Bruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.